I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source on the making and unmaking of maps. As it's unfolding in the Middle East today, it can be a gruesome process dominated by power politics and pitiless killing. But we're looking, too, for other patterns and possibilities of people's interests in a century when nation-state borders and identities will not be what they were. One Call is our guide to the territory and to the rising generation of worldly young Arabs. Professor Cole is the Middle East historian at the University of Michigan and a great star in the borderless realm of internet news and analysis at his own website, Informed Comment. One Cole's new book is called The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. No matter the sorry fate of the Arab Spring, we'll get to that book. Shayla Ben Habib is a philosopher and political scientist at Yale. She's our guide to an alternate universe of cosmopolitanism, of porous borders, of plural voices within nations, and dialogues that we don't hear much about between cultures. Labib Nasser is a Palestinian journalist studying at Harvard's Kennedy School. He's one of those young Arabs who will inherit the new world. We'll get to him too. But first, One Call, the story of the maps. Three in particular, Iraq, Syria, and Israel-Palestine. And on the way, here is a flashback from the closing scenes of betrayal in the film of Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence has fired up the Arab revolt against the Ottoman Turks, and he's been sold out by the colonial powers. His friend, King Faisal, played by Alec Guinness, walks out in this scene on British officials in royal disgust.
Well, General, I will leave you. Major Lawrence doubtless has reports to make about my people and their weakness and the need to keep them weak in the British interest. And the French interest, too, of course. We must not forget the French now.
I told you, sir, no such treaty exists.
Yes, General, you have lied most bravely, but not convincingly.
Are you sure you haven't heard of the Sykes-Picot Treaty?
No. I can guess.
Don't guess. Tell him.
Well, now, Mr. Sykes is an English civil servant. Mr. Picot is a French civil servant. Mr. Sykes and Mr. Picot met, and they agreed that after the war, France and England should share the Turkish Empire, including Arabia. They signed an agreement. Not a treaty, sir. An agreement to that effect.
There may be honor among thieves, but there's none in politicians.
And let's have no displays of indignation.
One Call, that was a century ago. I wish you'd just get us started by connecting the dots on the border issues today, in three places in particular, all falling apart or changing rapidly. Iraq, Syria, and then Israel-Palestine. Would you start in Iraq?
Sure. Well, these borders, as you indicate, were drawn by the victors of World War I. These territories had been part of the Ottoman Empire,
right,
ruled from Istanbul, a Muslim-dominant empire that straddled most of what we now call the Middle East. And its leadership at the time, called Young Turks, threw in with Austria and Germany in 1914 against Britain, France, and Russia. We historians widely view this decision on the part of the Young Turks as a mistake. And in the course of the war, Britain in particular made great inroads into the Ottoman Empire. And they almost immediately, later in 1914, once the war broken out, invaded southern Iraq from British India. And, you know, the British Empire had lots of centers of power. There was London, there was an Arab bureau in Cairo, but the British Indian government in New Delhi, you know, kind of had its own foreign policy, and they viewed Iraq as an appendage of British India, economically, diplomatically, and I think they wanted just to add it in to the other provinces like Punjab and so forth.
So come 21st century, Iraq is an assemblage of Kurds and Shias and Sunnis. In the war, maybe unanticipated consequence, or they should have anticipated, but the Shia and Iranian influence prevails. Those Sunni Iraqis are now in a wide open, vicious rebellion against that settlement. What's to say?
Right.
I mean, we're appalled by the violence of it, but I keep wondering, should we be surprised at the American toppling of what had, you know, for a century been Sunni domination in Iraq? Should we be surprised that it produced this now murderous blowback?
I don't think that it was inevitable that the Sunni Arabs and the Shia Arabs of Iraq would necessarily divide from one another or have this kind of rancor. Everything depends on policy. You know, after the fall of the apartheid government in South Africa, a decision was made by the African National Congress not to be vindictive. And in fact, you know, there are lots of war criminals that are walking free today in South Africa. Some of them got off simply by being willing to, in detail, confess their various crimes. And so there hasn't been, you know, that kind of violence or rancor in South Africa. It's not a racial paradise between whites and blacks that many people had feared, even though the power relations are now reversed. And I think that could have happened in Iraq if different policies had been adopted.
But explain the not only rancor, the viciousness and the force of it in Iraq today. It sounds as if the Sunni militias could overwhelm Baghdad once they decide to try it.
I don't think it's very likely that they can overwhelm Baghdad. I mean, anything can happen. I would be very surprised if that happened. Baghdad is probably on the order of now 85% Shiite. Because, although it had been 50-50 when Bush invaded in 2003, and in the course of 2006-2007, there was a civil war in Iraq between Shia and Sunni, in which the Sunnis of Baghdad were largely ethnically cleansed. And so this ISIL, or the so-called Islamic State, has seized power in the Sunni Arab north and West, largely by making alliances with dissidents against the Iraqi government of various sorts, and promoting what are essentially urban uprisings in Mosul, and Fallujah, and elsewhere against the government. It can't do that in Baghdad because the vast majority of the people in Baghdad now are Shiites.
But just measure the strength of that rebellion, and is Iraq to be saved? Is it for the United States to say that it has to be saved?
Well, first of all, you know, one question has to be asked is whether it can be saved.
Right.
And at the moment, its military has collapsed. Iraq, the Baghdad government in Iraq, has virtually no military offensive capability. And therefore, this current situation, whereby the so-called Islamic State has seized power in the Sunni Arab areas, is likely to continue for some time.
Speak of the Syrian situation again, as you know, in the context of 100 years, but in the context also of this sort of mafia rule of the Assad family. What's the prospect of that map, those borders, that falling apart?
Well, actually, at the moment, it seems entirely possible, and I should clarify this is not what I'm hoping for, but it seems entirely possible that the al-Assad government could end up winning in Syria and reasserting itself. Syria, again, was formed by those agreements made between France and Britain during World War I. The British promised Syria to the French. They double-booked it. How the airlines sometimes sell your seat to somebody else as well. So they promised it to the Arab leader, Sharif Hussein in Mecca, but they also promised it to to Georges Clemenceau in France. And after the war, Clemenceau rather insisted on getting what he was promised, and he had a bigger and more important army than Sharif Hussein did, and therefore the French simply invaded and took Syria. Once they had taken it, they found it rather difficult to rule, and a lot of people didn't want to be colonized by the French. They faced nationalism. So one thing they did was to carve out of Syria a Christian majority region, at least at that time, of Lebanon, in hopes that the Christians would be pro-French. And then inside Syria, when they made a military academy, they especially attracted people who were willing to serve the colonial power. And these were not the respectable people in society. And so they were rural youth from unorthodox religious sects like the Alawites, Shiites, and the Druze. And so as it came into being, Syrian, the French Syria, you know, had increasingly an officer corps and a military that was disproportionately drawn from Shiite minorities, even though it was a Sunni Arab majority country.
Hmm. Meantime, we've got to take account of a very different sort of changing of the map in Israel-Palestine, which was not foreseen in Sykes-Picot time, but suddenly, as you've been highlighting on your site, this four-stage map of the disappearing Palestinian footprint on what used to be called Palestine, it's now just scattered fragments on the map of what the world knows as Israel. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Speaking about borders in the Middle East, speaking of that infamous Sykes-Picot line that made the map of the Middle East, here was John Stewart's take on the Daily News with John Oliver in the role of Sir Archibald Mapsalot.
Archibald, it's just, you know, the borders that you drew back after World War I, well, they've proven to be a little unstable and somewhat controversial.
Really? Not a problem. We'll just draw them again. No problem. Yep.
That's the problem. You're a little cavalier about that.
Righty-ho. Well, this time I'll take great care. Quick scribble on the old globe. I guarantee you, before you know it, Bob's your uncle, it's gin o'clock. Let's take a look. I see your problem right here. The lines are too squiggly, right, John. As my father once told me, when borders get squiggly, people get squiggly.
Really?
What you want is a nice straight line, John. A nice straight line, straight as you can, like that. Lovely. Lovely.
Yeah, what you've done there, actually, though, is you've taken some land from Turkey, and then now you've got a Kurdish population there in a disputed zone.
Living in a where, John? This is imperialism, boy. First rule is don't overthink it. Second rule, don't think at all.
Juan Cole, we're going to come back to this matter of the borders of Palestine and Israel being churned up as we speak, I think, in Gaza. But I want to introduce Shayla Ben-Habib from Yale. She ran the program in Ethics, Politics, and Economics at Yale. She's a philosopher who brings a lot of personal perspectives to her work from a cosmopolitan childhood in Istanbul in a family of Jews originally expelled from Spain in 1492. Shayla Ben-Habib, give us a once-over on what's to look for. I mean, especially ways to change the context in which we see the world reorganizing itself.
Hi, Chris.
Shayla, welcome.
Good to be here with Juan. Maybe I want to begin first historically. Juan mentioned World War I and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, Sykes-Picot. But there was also a paradigm in people's minds at that time. And it wasn't just, you know, the paradigm in the heads of some imperial civil servants. Woodrow Wilson also inspired a lot of hopes in this region of the world. First with the Armenian peoples in the Ottoman Empire hoping to have some land. The Zionist movement at the time was also catching, you know, sort of fire. And this is the idea of one nation, one state, one territory. And this goes along also with principles of self-determination, because one left comfortably vague who the people or the nation were, you know, composed of. So this is a very paradoxical moment at the end of World War One, where, in fact, Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey, has to forge a Turkish nationalist identity out of a multinational, multi-ethnic empire the Ottomans used to have. We have 72 languages, 72 nations. We comprise them within us, right? So there's this paradigm in people's heads, which is also part of a process of modernization. It is part of a process of emancipation. It is the transition out of empire into self-rule, into democratic government. And in this process, borders, boundaries are being redrawn. If you look at a geographical map, you know, the ones that we used to study in classes of geography, there are no, I mean, the borders are presented by little dotted lines. But those dotted lines, what are they really? Those dotted lines cover over history, memory, identity, battles, exchanges, misery, as well as, you know, a great deal of humor, as we hear from the film portions that you have played in the program. So there has been a mismatch or a difficulty in reconciling these ideals of modern statehood, emancipated peoplehood on the one hand, and the historical reality of identities, particularly in this region, which was as difficult to unscramble as the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I mean, the unscrambling of Central Eastern Europe, in my opinion, was one of the causes of the Holocaust. And in the Middle East, we have had this kind of period of unscrambling with a collection of states, on either side of which live tribes and sects and groups. And into this whole regional unscrambling comes the extension of the European Holocaust, which is the founding of the State of Israel, okay, 1948. So 1914, 1948, different borders, different ideals, political modernization. The map is being redrawn, but not only in the sand, so to speak, but also in people's heads and imaginations of what it means to be a nation and no longer to be ruled by the sick men on the Bosphorus, as the Ottoman Sultan used to be called.
Sheila, I want to just pick up on the contradictions. I mean, there is an ocean now growing appallingly fast of something like almost 50 million quasi-permanent uprooted refugees on the run or displaced in some fashion or another. At the same time, there are rights, there are links, there are connections, there's communication, there are refuges, and there are even lofty principles like cosmopolitanism, with which I associate you, that offer at least different reality, a different future, perhaps. I mean, weigh that against the misery of 50 million refugees.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, let's go back for just one second to this, again, this moment of 1948, 47, the founding of the United Nations and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948. 1951, Convention on the Status of Refugees. This is a moment in which there are two principles that are now emerging into the world international society of states. And these are the principles, like the foundations of a house, which are still, you know, governing action. The first is the territorial integrity and sovereignty of states. When President Obama first objected to Russian manipulation of Ukraine, he said territorial integrity, territorial sovereignty, even though territories are completely permeable and historically determined, right? But this is one principle of sovereignty. Now, the second principle that gets also articulated is in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that somehow one's status as a person entitled to certain fundamental rights is not determined by the territory upon which one is or by the nation state towards which one belongs. To put it colloquially, the World Society of States speaks out of both sides of its mouth, and it never was able to reconcile these principles. And today, increasingly, in a global world of facility of communication, of travel, of knowledge, of interpersed relationships among individuals, we are beginning to face the real consequences of these two principles. Mm. And so what we have, right, Honduran children at our borders, 40,000-50,000 of them, who come because either their parents are here or because some relatives are here or because they've just heard that they could get a better life here and escape death. And what do we do? Well, we don't quite know, you know, how to distinguish between a refugee and an immigrant anymore in this country. A refugee is a person who faces almost sure persecution if rendered to his or her home of refuge. That's what it means to be a refugee.
These are Honduran children at our U.S. of A. borders. Juan Cole, I want you to continue where you left off on what's happening with the borders, the Israelification almost entirely of what was known as Palestine.
Yes, in 1947, the UN General Assembly presented a partition plan for Palestine, for the British Mandate of Palestine, which then had, roughly 500,000 Jews and well over 1 million Palestinians. A war broke out. And when the shooting was all done, the Palestinian portion of that map had shrunk somewhat. But Gaza, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank were not originally given to Israel by the UN, and nor did they succeed in conquering those areas during the 1947-48 war. But in 1967, when war broke out between Israel and Egypt and Syria and Jordan, the Israelis seized those territories, and they thereafter decided to colonize them. And there have been all along, and now it has, seems to have become almost a majority opinion, Israelis who think they should never relinquish them. The problem is they want the land of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, but they don't want the 4.3 million Palestinians that are living on the land. Mm. And they won't give them citizenship. They won't let them have the rights of a person who has citizenship. So the Palestinians remain stateless. And being stateless means that you really are not secure in your property. If someone does something to you, commits a tort against you, you have to apply to Israeli courts for relief, and they are not sympathetic. And so you have a horrible human rights situation of the Palestinians living in under Israeli occupation, which now seems to have become a kind of apartheid, on analogy from what happened in South Africa. And it now seems to be becoming a permanent state of apartheid.
Will they ever get a chance to fight the legal claim that the colonization of conquered territory is illegal?
Yes, in the United Nations Charter, because Hitler gave aggressive war rather a bad name, the United Nations in its charter in 1945 attempted to outlaw the acquisition of territory by war. So what Israel did in 1967 in acquiring the West Bank and Gaza is illegal if what they intended to do was simply to incorporate that territory into Israel. And then, moreover, they are occupied territories in international law, and reacting against the excesses of the horrors of the Axis. The world community enacted the Geneva Conventions of 1949 on the treatment of occupied peoples. You can't transfer population from the occupier into the occupied territories by international law, and nor can you treat the occupied territories as enemy territories and commit military violence against them. They're under the aegis, under the protection of the occupying force. And so most of Israeli policy towards the West Bank and Gaza is illegal in international law. And if it came before the International Criminal Court in The Hague, the Israelis certainly would be found guilty.
Shayla, I wonder what your take is on the sacredness of those territorial map and the partition of Palestine, but also on the rights involved of the Palestinian peoples.
I think that most of what Yuan says is correct. I agree with him on this as well. But we cannot keep the politics also completely out of the question. I mean, there undoubtedly what happens in the whole region is that, particularly between Israel and Palestine, is the moment when something like a plausible agreement and equilibrium is reached, something like, let's say, the Oslo Accords emerge. There are many, many distinct players who have the capacity to just set off the other side. And they each use, I mean, some of the most extreme elements on each side use the excuse of the other's behavior to go ahead. This is exactly what is happening now. The Netanyahu government rose up to the bait. They know precisely that Hamas cannot control many of the factions that have access to these rockets. They know that, and yet they use this as an excuse to go out and simply take out an entire generation of rockets. Now, that's at the level of politics that's been going on for decades in the region. At the level of principle, one has to tread carefully here. Again, there are issues of cultural and historical memory and identity that play into this equation, in the sense that there is a struggle within Israel itself as to what Israel means, whether it means the sacred land of Israel or whether it means the modern state of Israel. It is this conflict that has led to the assassination of Rabin by an Israeli fanatic. There is this deep, deep, deep division within the country itself. And it is also this deep division that is leading a lot of the governments to a situation of absolute paralysis. Mm. Add to this a different kind of immigration in the last numbers of years that have come into Israel. Again, many, many Russian Jews, about a million, a completely different ideological mix of identities, mix of memories, mix of history. And the progressive dreams of, you know, Zionism are no longer there. Maybe Yuan and I disagree that there was a moment of a progressive dream of Zionism. There were many Zionist binationalists, socialists who wanted equality with the Arab peoples of, you know, Palestine. Those dreams are, you know, drying up on the bud now because of the situation on the ground. So as far as the rights of the Palestinian peoples, I mean, one thing that I would like to just put forward is the possibility of acknowledging the profound and deep interdependence that has been now created with both the Gaza Strip and, you know, the West Bank. I mean, Israel controls air rights. It controls water rights. And if indeed it thinks that, you know, it can live as an apartheid regime, it's wrong. Sooner or later, apartheid regimes disappear in history. So is there a way forward? I'm a federationalist. It's a different formula than a binational state.
I was going to say, what would a cosmopolitan understanding do to that knot? We're talking about borders and rights and refugees and people and the maps, the alternative maps of emergent Arab nations. This is Open Source. I want to go back to you, Juan Cole, and the argument of your book on the new Arabs, that the bloodshed, the embarrassments, the setbacks of the Arab Spring notwithstanding, we've crossed a watershed here, and that there's no going back, that there is a new population of millennial Arabs with different goals, less attachment perhaps to faith, more worldly, and ready for something different. Walk us through that argument, particularly, and I'd be a little skeptical, given the incredible disappointments of the politics of the Arab Spring in Egypt, for example, which I saw with my own eyes.
Yes. Well, there's certainly been a roller coaster ride. I won't deny that. But this new generation, the generation born from the late 70s through about the year 2000, is quite distinctive from their parents. They're much more urban. They're much more literate. They're much more wired and cosmopolitan. They are at least somewhat less religiously observant. It doesn't mean that they don't value religion or it's not very important to them. It is, but they don't listen to the Quran as much. They don't pray as much and so forth as their parents. And in some countries, as in Lebanon and Tunisia, the distinction on religious observance in the generations is quite marked. So they were faced with the situation in 2010, where in many of these countries, they had not only a dictator, but the dictator was becoming dynastic. There was a president for life, and then his sons were going to take over or his relatives after him. These were very nepotistic, corrupt regimes. They were like family cartels. The U.S. Embassy in 2006 estimated that 50% of the Tunisian economic elite was related to the president. Mm. This is nepotism on a vast scale. And so people, you know, what that means is that people are blocked from economic opportunities by the state and the cronies. And so they were determined that these presidents for life were no longer going to be president. And moreover, especially that their children were not going to inherit the Arab youth like so many sticks of furniture. And in that, they have succeeded. And for all of the other problems that have come in the wake, you can't take that away from them. That building system of Republican monarchy, that's on the trash heap of history.
True enough. But then again, the elected Muslim Brotherhood president of Egypt has been deposed. So democracy is in ruins in a sense. And the new General Sisi has, you know, in terms of torture, in terms of unilateral kind of tyranny, has too many resemblances with the Mubarak regime. I mean, locate the gain again, the practical gain. What we saw in those elections was that the army had a huge block of power and votes. The Brotherhood had a huge block of power and votes. But the young folk, the intellectuals, the educated liberal forces did not have a political base. Who's to say they're ever going to have one?
Well, first of all, I always stress to people, and you know, it's an excellent question. You know Egypt well, and I agree with you. We're at, you know, a low point in Egyptian politics in the aftermath of 2011. But people often ask me, you know, why didn't the youth get more involved in politics or form governments or whatever? And I reply to them that they're 20. A lot of them were undergraduates, mm-hmm. the equivalent. And most of these countries, they're not old enough still to stand for office. And therefore, they put their efforts into networking and more kind of horizontal kinds of organizations. Mm-hmm. And their goals are much more inchoate than simply, you know, gaining political office. And those goals, you know, have not disappeared, and neither has the generation. So in a place like Egypt, obviously the elite, not the top elite, because I think they're gone. I mean, there were a number of billionaires around dictator Hosni Mubarak who are now on trial or in exile, including his sons. The next level down, not the billionaires, but the millionaires, were spooked by what happened and have closed ranks with the military and have made a counter-revolution. But it's not a complete counter-revolution because, for instance, the new constitution that was passed limits the president to two four-year terms. Mm-hmm. So there can't be any more presidents for life. It gives complete equality in the law. We'll see if this remains on paper or not, to women. There is a provision for parliamentary elections, which have yet to happen in this year in Egypt. And the parliament now has more power than it used to. And I was in Egypt in March, and I was talking to people about how horrible this authoritarian plebiscite was, that where General Sisi was elected by 97% of the vote. Obviously, this is a joke. But they said, well, you know, we understand that. Sisi is anyway very popular and very powerful, but we're putting our efforts into the parliamentary elections. And Egypt is now a multi-party political system. And while one of the parties, the Muslim Brotherhood, has been banned from participating under its own rubric, there are lots of liberal and leftist parties that are intending to contest these elections.
It's going to be worth watching. Juan Cole, I think we have sort of confirmation of your general view in our studio. Labib Nasser is my guest. He's a Palestinian from Jerusalem. He's a reporter with Reuters Television, and he covered the Arab Spring from North Africa into the bloodbath in Syria. And he's young enough to qualify for the millennial rising generation designation. And I think he agrees with you that for all the awful disappointments, most especially in Syria, something is altogether different going into the future. Labib?
Yes, I do come from the generation of the late 70s, so I fit that generation. From my observation in Egypt, I think one thing that I disagree with is the youth involvement. You don't see it happening in the government, or that's because they might have set the bar a bit too high. They are not playing the game, if the that, you know, the powers that have come to take over are asking them to play in order to get a role in the future of the government. So there's been a lot of maybe boycotting by those liberal youth who were in Tahrir Square leading the revolution, especially in the first few days, and I'm talking about the 2011, not 2013 revolution. There was fear that once existed under Mubarak that was completely broken. People, the youth have felt empowered and they can take to the streets and speak their mind. Not only the youth, you could see it shortly after the revolution, workers at banks, at different institutes would take to the street and put out banners and demonstrate and call for their rights. So there was a newfound freedom and democracy, freedom of expression that they never had.
I guess I want to know who's going to draw the line against the police torture, sort of this kind of gross brutality that continues as in the old regime, but also what are the markers that establish sort of points of no return, back to the bad old ways, in a situation that looks too much like the bad old Mubarak days?
Well, I think the marker is whether General Sisi will bring elections to Egypt in 4 years, as he had promised to. If that happens, then what most Egyptians were counting on, from my gauging with them, is that they want a strong man to get a hold of the country again and to rebuild Egypt and to take us into democracy. They realized what they were getting on board with. And for them, this was the better choice for Egypt, and they wanted the world to respect that. This is what I gauge from the street. Now, Mind you, the youth who were educated and liberal did not get involved or mainly boycotted. And also Muslim Brotherhoods or sympathizers of Muslim Brotherhood were not even allowed to speak out out of fear.
I just wonder who's going to enforce it. Who's going to enforce this bright understanding, one call?
Well, power hasn't gone away. You know, I agree entirely that a lot of the engaged youth boycotted the constitutional referendum in January. They boycotted the presidential election. I watched Egyptian satellite television during the presidential election, and the anchors were beside themselves that where are the youth, where are the youth? It was very clear that old people, old women seemed to really like General Sisi and voted for him in large numbers.
Right.
But people power didn't go away. When I was in Egypt in March, it was more or less, you know, as you say, military rule. But Egypt was racked with labor strikes up and down the Nile. The workers felt that Sisi was making promises to improve their lives. Well, where's our raise? And the postal workers went on strike. And of course, that paralyzes a lot of commerce. And General Sisi came on television and begged them to please go back to work. And nothing was done to them. You know, the state didn't want to tangle with these organized workers. So it looked on the outside like this is a very authoritarian situation. But, you know, I very much doubt whether those strikes on that scale could have been pulled off under Mubarak. And so I just want to underline that there's a lot of talk about authoritarianism, and there is, you know, a reassertion of the secret police, and there is some police torture, as you said. But the people have learned how to push back against these things, and that grip of fear or that grip of hopelessness that made it possible before really has been much weakened. And there will be ups and downs. The game is not over.
I want to just testify from my own month in Egypt in 2012 that it's not a political revolution. It's not a social revolution, much less an economic revolution. But there is some sort of emotional revolution in the war of fathers and sons. It's an immensely patriarchal society with sort of the grandfather of them all, 80-plus-year-old Mubarak, the model of it. It runs through all those Naguib Mahfouz novels, the iron rule of the father, the non-education of the girls. That somehow has been broken. You had a feeling that what did go on in Egypt was this open argument in a million, maybe millions of households between fathers and the sons won in a fashion. That will not be restored. But in what time we have left, I'd like everybody just to comment on the sort of the dignity piece in this emerging Arab world. One, I mean, what is the dignity threshold among your millennials? And I'd love Sheila and Labib to comment on it too.
Yes, one of the slogans that the youth often deployed was dignity or karama. They felt as though they were being disrespected, being dissed by the secret police, by the regular police, by the regime. And they demanded to be treated with respect. And I think, you know, the regime is at least a little bit more afraid of them than it was. And I do want to underline that Egypt is not the only country involved here. And in Tunisia, I think you've had a much better outcome so far. And I think the Tunisian people have enormously more dignity than they had in 2010.
Sheila Ben Habib, measure the dignity quotient.
Dignity is hard to measure by any scale, but I do agree with Juan that particularly what has happened in Tunisia is quite interesting. I mean, I followed some of the debate about women's international rights in the Tunisian parliament because both Egypt and Tunisia are signatories to CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Discrimination Against Women. And so one of the questions was, what would happen, you know, would one accept the standards established by CEDAW, which are quite demanding and which we in the United States still have not ratified, by the way. And in fact, the Tunisian parliament, despite the possible conflict between Sharia law and CEDAW, has ratified in its either Article 46 or 47, one of the most extensive promises of gender freedom, equality between men and women in the Middle East. So I agree that I think that the Arab Spring has really lit something up. As a political theorist, I would say democracy takes a long time. The transition from autocracy, military regimes to democracy is not automatic. And there is a little bit of a naivete in the international community to expect simply that democratic institutions emerge out of the formal mechanisms of the ballot box without some of the constitutional play and interaction between democracy and constitutionalism sort of working itself out. So there are some interesting developments and signs, and let us just hope that maybe this new sense of dignity also creates a sense of openness and multiculturalism and acceptance and tolerance, which may bring some new perspective on the Israel-Palestinian conflict, wherever it comes from.
Yeah, let's hope. Labib Nasser, how secure is this new dignity foothold?
I think, you know, at a region where two-thirds of the population is under 35, and they were counting on the father to deliver them to where they needed to go, and they got betrayed over and over and over by this father who wanted to give the government over to his son, the presidency. Mm. That's when the dignity kicked in. That's when people said enough is enough, and they broke a barrier that they hadn't had before. And also in the age of, you know, social media and openness, they have been empowered by being able to express themselves and to get support and to network using the social media. And the idea that they hold so dear and that they were raised up, you know, knowing that it's important, the dignity became something they can actually defend.
Speak about Palestinian dignity.
Palestinian dignity, I mean, if we talk about the borders in Palestine, if for me, growing up, I used to be able to go to Jerusalem, and Ramallah and Gaza to swim at the beach, and it was fine. The generation before me, my parents' generation, they used to be able to have breakfast in Beirut and lunch in Jerusalem, and that was okay. Today, a 5-mile drive from Ramallah to Jerusalem involves crossing a border. Mm. So the borders are physically increasing, but maybe the borders, the virtual borders, are actually disappearing. People are able to communicate faster, easier with one another.
We'll stick with it and hope for the best. Thank you, Labib Nasser. Thank you, Sheila Ben Habib. Thank you, Juan Cole. Also, Nasser Rabat, Rashid Khalidi, Hilary Rantisi, thank you all. You can continue the discussion about borders in the Middle East and elsewhere on our website, radioopensource.org. And you can have a look at other conversations, including our series on artists in the Arab Spring. Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Open Source. Our show this week was produced by the Young Turks, Max Larkin, Kunal Jasti, engineered by George Hicks. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon.